Good morning, friends. Years ago, when I was just starting out in journalism, one of my editors told me about a tenet in the Quaker religion known as the responsibility of witness. The idea was that if you see something wrong, hear something dangerous, or learn something out of the ordinary, you are morally obligated to respond in some fashion. I never learned if this maxim was his own invention or actual Quaker doctrine, but it was good advice for a rookie reporter at the Daily Iowan in Iowa City trying to find out what news to cover. And in fact, it's useful for any person in any age or occupation. In a moral life, there is no indifference, no bystandering. If you see something, testify to what you have witnessed. If you observe something meaningful, say it, sing it, write it. Now, when Reverend Arnold asked me to speak today about politics and faith with an eye toward this lovely approaching election, I went in search of a thing I've seen over the years that you may be familiar with. It's a list of important issues or campaigns that were decided by a single vote. What better way to show the meaning of democracy? What finer illustration of the philosophy radical in 1776 and not entirely mainstream today, that all people are equal, that God endowed us all at birth with profound rights, that rather than being subjects lorded over by an omnipotent king, we are citizens, each capable of and entrusted with a role in the nation's governance, each likewise sharing a responsibility in the nation's well-being. 30 seconds on the internet and there was my list. A margin of one vote gave Cromwell control of England. A one-vote majority caused Charles I to be executed. One vote brought Texas and the United States. Adolf Hitler won control of the Nazi Party by one vote, and there were more, on and on. I love these stories. They validate much of the faith that I bring with me into the ballot booth. Among the multitudes, somehow I matter. If I could boil democracy down to its essence, that might be it. Among the multitudes, each person matters. This may be as much a spiritual concept as a political one. Imagine my dismay, therefore, when I investigated these one-vote stories a bit deeper and discovered that all of them were false. Parliament dissolved itself before Cromwell even came to power. King Charles I was indeed executed, but only after a trial and a verdict signed by 59 court commissioners. Texas became a state after a Senate vote of 27-25 and a House vote of 132-75. The wrongest one of all was about Hitler, who became head of the Nazi Party by a vote of 553-1. The tales I had loved were bunk. Now, I'm a person with an affection for things I do not know or understand, and discovering that I had swallowed falsehoods wholesale was extremely interesting. I especially found myself dwelling on that one person who stood against Hitler. He must have had an inkling of how the party would vote. He had to know that Hitler would not condone any voice raised in opposition. Yet he voted his conscience anyway. That's the guy who maybe has something to teach us. First, though, I need to jump to Jeanette Rankin. She and this nameless German have something important in common with each other, and perhaps in common with us. Born in 1880 to a Montana rancher and his school teacher wife, Rankin was a lifelong pacifist and agitator for women to have the vote. In 1911, she addressed the Montana legislature about suffrage and argued so persuasively that the state decided not to wait for the rest of the country and allowed, in 1914, allowed women to vote. Next election, Rankin ran for Congress and won. She was the first woman to hold a federal office. Among other things, that means she was there when the constitutional amendment giving women the vote nationwide came up for congressional debate, making her the only woman to cast a federal vote to enable women to vote. But this is not what made her famous. That moment came in 1917, when President Woodrow Wilson called on Congress to declare war on Germany. 50 House members voted no. The 49 men received some criticism, but as the lone female, Rankin was publicly vilified, called unpatriotic, and held up as exactly the reason women should not be allowed to vote. Montana's response was to change its congressional district lines, placing Rankin in one now dominated by an opposing party, thereby ending her political career. Until 1940, that is, when she ran for Congress again and won again. Now Rankin was 60 and even more firmly a pacifist. So, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, President Roosevelt called on Congress to declare war. Every member of Congress dutifully did so, except one. The 1941 reaction made 1917 look like a picnic. Rankin was so hounded by reporters and critics, she had to hide in a phone booth until Capitol Police arrived to protect her. Her own brother sent a telegram, "Montana is 100% against you." Rankin issued a statement that she was not against this war, but all war. 2 days later, Congress voted on going to war against Germany and Italy. She abstained both times. Once again, her political career was over. Until 1972, that is. By then, Rankin was 91 years old. She ran for Congress anyway in opposition to the Vietnam War. Before the election, she was compelled to withdraw for health reasons. Basically, her voice gave out. Which leads me to ask, how is your voice today? How is your upholding of the moral responsibility of witness? Because we have all just witnessed a campaign cycle which has been the most negative, most unpleasant, most coarse in modern history. I am not talking about the candidates. I'm talking about our fellow Americans. I'm talking about us. Violence by the public at campaign events has rivaled those during the battles over the first labor unions 80 years ago. The online conduct has been far worse, from liberal women's blogs being overwhelmed with pornographic posts to a conservative writer opening his email to find Photoshop pictures of his grade school daughter being murdered in various ways. Even in our conversations, our neighborly debates, there is an intolerance I do not associate with any prior election in my life. This is the ugliness of our time, and to some degree, we have all witnessed it. The question is what to do. In my view, the answer is not found in the polling place, not in serene Charlotte, Vermont, where we will visit the elementary school to cast our ballot and say hello to friends and then go peacefully about the day's business. I believe the answer awaits on November 9th, the day after the election, when the campaigns will thankfully end, but the troubles our nation faces will not. A record number of children homeless. In Burlington alone, about 150 kids a day go to school from a shelter. A record number of people hungry. In Vermont, a third of them are kids, which means that when there is a snow day, and therefore no school breakfast or lunch, 27,000 kids don't eat. A record number of deaths due to addiction. 400,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. A record level of suicides, especially among older and middle-aged men. And in my view, this includes the attempted suicide that caused the staggering quintuple homicide on the interstate 2 weeks ago. And there's more, and that's before we even look at the world. These are problems too large for Washington to fix. Even if there was a political will to make change, the federal government now owes a record debt, nearly $20 trillion. Should a consensus somehow miraculously occur, there is no money to feed those kids or give them a stable place to sleep. If you accept the conventional predictions, meanwhile, Hillary Clinton will win, Donald Trump will sue to contest the results in at least 4 states, the Senate will refuse to vote on anyone she nominates for the Supreme Court, and the House will impeach her for the email misconduct. Business, in other words, as frustratingly usual. To solve the problems our world faces, therefore, any genuine solution will require us, all of us, to shut out the din, to find common purpose, to be willing to stand out. Yet we know what happens to that kind of person, and it is not a trail of glory. Jeanette Rankin lost every time she voted with her conscience and was thrown out of office too. The man who voted against Hitler probably paid with his life. Gandhi preached nonviolence and was shot to death with a pistol. Martin Luther King called America to the higher ground of racial justice and equality and was shot to death with a rifle. And then there is the person, divine, yes, but also entirely human, who was the ultimate solitary voice, who said incredibly radical things like, love your neighbor as yourself. If a man wrongs you, forgive him 7 times 70 times. And if someone strikes you, instead of striking back, turn the other cheek. Judge not. Blessed be the poor in spirit. Whatsoever you do for the least of my brothers, that you do unto me. And what we fellow humans did to this outcast was whip him and crown him with thorns and put him to death on a cross. Yet there are great rewards to being the one vote, the standout, just not the kind you would expect. People of conscience value acts of conscience. Jeanette Rankin is revered by history, while those men who voted against World War I are forgotten. Gandhi led nations to freedom without warfare. King's influence remains vital 50 years after his assassination, as this country continues to reckon with its legacy of racism. And above all, the executed radical who preached love and forgiveness continues to change the world more than 2,000 years after his death. That is the power of faith. That is the power of conscience. The work of healing America is a high calling. Just as each of us benefits from the liberties and promise of this country, each of us must share in the burden of helping it to heal from its injuries. Now, I wish I could offer a prescription of specifics, 10 steps to a more humane nation, 3 strategies for unity. I can't. It's too large, and it's too complex. But I know the medicine when I see it. The Habitat for Humanity houses, built in this town of many mansions. That's some. The outreach this faith community has made toward new Americans working on our farms, that's a dose too. The food shelf, the volunteers at the senior center, and fire and rescue, the people who have made so many fantastic apple pies here, these are all manifestations of the responsibility of witness. If you participated in any of these enterprises, you know a person's politics do not matter during good deeds, whether he is building a house or she is receiving one. Partisanship has no place at the food shelf because hunger is democratic with a small d. When it comes to apple pie, we are all on the same side. So it turns out the easy stories weren't actually true. It turns out that weaving a national fabric that is compassionate, maybe even kind, tolerant, and forgiving, takes work. Over this past year of campaigns, we've all borne witness to the opposite of that work. Perhaps we may now, therefore, turn our emotions about that negativity into something else, based on faith, based on conscience. Perhaps we can contemplate the good and healing effects of philanthropy and volunteerism in our community and decide to do more. Perhaps, starting November 9th, we can devote ourselves in the way Abraham Lincoln suggested after the Great Schism of the Civil War, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. Let us strive to finish the work that we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and orphan, to all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. So may we live to witness. Amen. Yeah.
Let's join together in singing hymn number 482, Forward Through the Ages.